Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 396. What Did They Do Next? Part 5b, Patrick Mraz.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 396 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. Do please get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week is the second part of our look at what Patrick Mraz did after leaving Yes. So we've been listening to his second solo album, Out in the Sun, which is a slightly surprising record. Here are reactions and discussions in a few moments. In the Patreon group this week, I posted a sneak preview of something we have in the can for episode 400. More on that next week. This week on Facebook, Preston Frazier shared the wonderful Bill Bruford Earthworks complete box set, as well as an interview with the Good Doctor, and Mark gives us an update on his latest solo album. I loved Julio Rivera's reposting of Brick Wakeman in Lego, and in the visitor posts, Jeffrey Mason added Stephen Schindler's review of Big Generator, an odd story about Rick Wakeman and sheep, an interview with Rick, and three with Dr. Bruford, as well as two Steve Howe features and John Anderson's long version of WDMCF. Wow. Charles Christopher shares what he describes as a saucy Yes t-shirt, based on the cover of Going for the One, and over on Twitter, Henry Potts has more rumours of a new Yes album, and Yes Official shared the full Billy Sherwood interview from that 50th anniversary documentary. Many thanks to everyone who commented on the show notes for last week, that's Dave Watkinson, Stephen Lamb, Doug Curran and Tony Handley, as well as everyone who got involved in any way this week. From the very little information available online about this album, Out in the Sun, it's clear that most people see it as Story of I Part 2. Bizarrely, in some places I've seen, Out in the Sun described as Patrick Mraz's debut solo album. I'm not quite sure what that makes Story of I, which predates this album by a year. So listening for the first time, I'm wondering exactly what I'll hear. The first song, which is also the title track, is credited to Mraz and McBurney, who provides vocals on most of the album and was also involved in Story of I. The song begins with the same happy fiesta feeling as the previous album, but almost immediately the vocals come in and put a rather different slant on it. There's lots of Latin American instruments, instrumentation, and a pulsating mobile bass line, but there are also hints of progressive time shifts and some gorgeous synth soloing from Mraz himself. It almost tips over into poppy easy listening, but just about manages to rescue itself with some great harmony singing and that interesting jaunty rhythmic dexterity. It's very good fun indeed, and full of plenty of Mraz's keyboard touches to please the fan. It's relatively short at 4.5 minutes, but a good start to the album. Rana Batacuda, hope I'm pronouncing that somewhere near correctly, starts with some sci-fi sounds and some refreshing piano against Latin American percussion and voices. It's an intriguing mix with vocal gymnastics unlike any Western song. Vocalizations, I suppose they'd be called, which are an interesting accompaniment to some of the piano harmonies, which are much more recognizable. After a time, there are strident chords from piano and then a dance feel kicks in and it sounds like it was recorded live in a club. Again, the rhythm is infectious and you can't help but move to the music. For me, this is more effective than the opening song, with a wonderful piano glissando and then synth and piano duet. The melodies are memorable and packed with the feel of South America. You can almost smell the aromas of Brazil in this street carnival of a piece. Mraz still finds way of integrating church organ sounds and sparkling synth pitch-bending solos, a fascinating 5.5 minutes of instrumental music, which returns to sci-fi noises at the end. Incidentally, Google Translate claims Rana means frog, and Wikipedia tells me that Batacuda is a sub-style of samba and refers to an African-influenced Brazilian percussive style, usually performed by an ensemble known as a bateria. I found a YouTube video of a masked bateria playing a batucada, which I've put in the show notes for this week. It gives a bit of context to Mraz's version. Very fun carnival music. Just as intriguing is the name of the next song, Nervous Breakdown. It starts with a straight vamp and bass line on keys, and then some harmony vocals joins in. It's pure pop, with a really good lyrical vocal melody. There's quite a bit of interesting harmonic complexity, though, and lots of brilliant synth runs and traditional solo lead guitar. Very different from the Latin American feel of the previous songs. It's a tiny bit like Mike Oldfield in instrumental approach, but not in the vocals. That's more like an electric light orchestra vibe, and it's very pleasant indeed. A strong poppy tune with Meraz's trademark gorgeous synth soloing, where he sort of channels Oldfield's guitar approach, interestingly. Silver Screen is next. This one begins with a beautiful piano part before more great lead vocals bring us a simple song backed by a chorus of backing singers. Once again, it's pop rather than prog or rock music, but a very fine version of the genre. It feels like we've moved to New York from the south of the continent now after those two songs. There's a pleasant middle section infused with explorative vocal musings, and the power and quality of those lead vocals are shown once again. The drums and bass also add strong parts to support Meraz and his synth again. A bit of a storytelling number and compellingly put together, with a growth of intensity powered by the instrumental arrangement and production to the satisfying end. The title of the next song, Tentacles, may seem like an invitation to some kind of horror show, but in fact there's more piano work at the start of this one, and even more of an easy-listening style, but not unattractive. Once again, this is pop with a happy-go-lucky feel and great lead vocals. There's a bit of a gospel feel to this love song, and Meraz adds Hammond organ to press the point home in addition to his piano. This one is a bit too MOR for me. It's millions of miles away from Relayer or Story of I, a pretty forgettable pop tune which I'm sure Mark will be able to classify. Doobie Brothers or something like that. Too standard late 70s chart stuff for me, despite a wonderful Meraz synth solo to complete it, unfortunately cut off in its prime by the fade-out. Kabbalah is next. I looked the word up and very much enjoyed the definition from dictionary.com. It says, a system of esoteric theosophy and theurgy developed by rabbis, reaching its peak about the 12th and 13th centuries and influencing certain medieval and Renaissance Christian thinkers. It was based on a mystical method of interpreting scripture by which initiates claimed to penetrate sacred mysteries. Among its central doctrines are all creation is an emanation from the deity and the soul exists from eternity. It's surprising Meraz didn't get on better with Anderson. Anyway, another shorter song at just under 5 minutes. It starts with a fantastic drum pattern, echoing those Latin American rhythms again, something like a bossa nova, but don't quote me on that. Keys initially create a fascinating soundscape, but then, a little disappointingly for me, electric piano comes in to create a late-night moonlight lounge experience. Not my kind of music, I'm afraid. Meraz plays it all expertly, of course, but I'm not much of a lounge lizard. The Hammond organ solo is fabulous, but also somewhat predictable. This instrumental could easily find itself as background music in a 70s cop film. It's fine, but not a style I can see myself seeking out again, which is quite a surprise on this album for me. Very groovy. So what lies in store for the next song, Love, Hate, Sun, Rain, You? How's that for a title? Science fiction is back on the menu here as Meraz rips up an amazing concoction of sounds in a fantastic section. It's almost worth buying the album just for this masterclass in electronic music. Next, we have a jazzy, fusion-y, full band introduction to a rock and roll number in the shuffle rhythms and lead vocal stylings of Deep Purple. Think My Woman from Tokyo, or similar. It's very enjoyable with harmony guitar parts and screaming vocals. It's possible that some of the soloing is Meraz rather than electric lead guitar, I'm not sure, but this is great stuff. Exploratory instrumental sections are followed by rocking vocal passages, and Meraz throws in some of the fastest piano runs I've ever heard. A song brimming over with energy and completely different to everything else on the album so far. Finally, we reach Time for Change, which has the subtitle Medley and consists of the following sections in its 9 minutes. Time to Fly, Big Bands of Ancient Temples, Serenade, and Back to Nature. Time to Fly is a wonderful and beautifully atmospheric soundscape of synth textures. I could listen to this all day. It's creative, but doesn't stray into new age randomness. Where the sections change, I have no idea, but Meraz adds solo synth lines which bend and twirl in a magnificent manner. A sudden key change fills the speakers with a more dramatic and intense feel featuring timpani and other percussion. Some of the backing organ sounds somewhat reminiscent of the fish out of water textures, but then Meraz brings in the grand piano and scrolls energetically through lots of keys in undulating, fast-moving patterns, owing quite a bit to classical piano techniques. This works really well for me, and this suite is certainly meant to be a progressive construction. Suddenly the music ebbs and the Back to Nature vocals come in. The line has some interesting lyrics and shapes, and the acoustic bass is a perfect accompaniment. The music steers well clear of nightclub jazz or MOR, and turns out to be a really interesting piece, with plenty of interesting and engaging moments. It's a great end to the album, with the maestro at the piano.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to part 5B of What Did They Do Next with Patrick Meraz and the Out in the Sun album. So last week we briefly talked about the Out in the Sun album, as it was the first work that Patrick did after leaving Yes. And as I mentioned briefly during the last part that we did, it's an album that I very much enjoy, which, you know, obviously I have a few copies in my collection, and always found that Patrick's keyboard work was fantastic. In fact, I'll go one further and say that Patrick is one of those keyboard players which I'll put alongside Igor Koryshev as one of the members that I was very saddened that left the band. I mean, obviously, when Patrick was in the band, I had yet to even discover Yes. This was like 1974, 75. So I obviously wasn't listening to Yes at that point. But the impact that he had on Yes music at the time that he was in was very big to me. I mean, he was involved with the record that I still to this day consider the best Yes album of all time, which is Relayer. Now, looking at this album, one would think that he would take some of the things that he tried to do with Yes and maybe put it into his solo albums. A lot of the times what ends up happening is you hear when people leave bands, sometimes they leave because of differences of opinion or there's a big conflict over something. And a lot of the times it's based around songwriting and songwriting credits. And what ends up happening is the songs that weren't used by that member in the band, he ends up recording on his solo records. Now, listening to this record, while it has Patrick Meraz's stamp all over it, I don't really hear too much Yes style of music per se on here. In fact, I'm going to quote myself, because I did do a review of this album a while back, which we'll get to in a minute, and I did say that this album reminded me of sort of California rock music. It's very uplifting in moments, and it has a very sunny feeling to it as far as the sound. It gives me that very much that impression of an open highway by a beach somewhere with the sun blurring down it. And he still, of course, has his Brazilian influences on here as well. Not as much as in the story of I, obviously, but they are still present on this record. Now I'm going to do something that I haven't done before, and that is, while I was listening back to this record, I came to realize that my opinions on this record haven't changed since the first time I've heard it. So instead of repeating myself, I'm going to go back into the time machine and pull out my actual review that I did of this album on that fateful day of January 31st, 2017. So let's go over to that segment now. So this week, we're going to talk about a Patrick Meraz album. Now, before I discuss which album this is, I'm just going to preface this by saying that every once in a while, there comes a time when I'm genuinely surprised by an album. Surprised at how good it is, because actually, before I sat down and listened to this record, I really didn't know what to expect. The Story of I, which is Patrick's first album, I enjoyed very much. It was quite the mix of Brazilian and progressive music, so it was a very interesting listen, and it was quite the impressive layout as far as the lyrics and the story that he provided within the record. So today, I'm going to be reviewing his second album, Out in the Sun. After hearing Story of I expected that maybe this would be more of the same, and boy, was I ever wrong. But in the usual fashion, before we get started, let's go over some of the technical details of this record. So Out in the Sun was released on January 20th, 1977. It was recorded at Phonogram Studios in Rio de Janeiro and Aquarius Studios in Geneva, Switzerland. And it was recorded between February and March of 1976. It was mastered at Sterling Sound in New York City by George Marino, and the lacquer was cut by Ray Staff, a pretty well-known lacquer cutter. The record also came out on Charisma Records, and in the United States, it got out on a different label for some reason. And that, ironically, is the pressing that I have, which is on Import Records. The record was produced by Patrick Meraz and Gene Ristori. And I'd also like to make note of the musicians that played on this record, besides Patrick, who played keyboards, obviously, you have John McBurney on vocals, and you also have Francois Zimmerou, who did vocals on one song, which is called Love, Hate, Sun, Rain, You. You also have Ray Gomez on guitar, Warnell Jones on bass, and Andy Newmark on drums. So let's talk about the music. So as I mentioned earlier, I was a little unsure what to think about this record. And after listening to it, I have to say that this is one of the most surprising records I've listened to in a very long time. The South American influence that was so present on Story of I is here, but not nearly as much. In fact, out of the 8 songs that are on this record, it only really appears in 2 songs. The rest of the songs are really upbeat, very much in a more rock and roll vein. They do have elements of progressive music within them, but it's a lot more, dare I say, like California rock and roll in spots. And the singing on this record is just absolutely fantastic. I think more than anything, that was the thing that surprised me the most. The singing that was done by John McBurney is just really, really top shelf. He has that really great raspy kind of whiskey voice, and it suits the music really well. And that's one thing that surprised me more than anything about Patrick in his songwriting, was that he could write some really catchy rock songs. And some of it is almost borderlining on hard rock in some spots, which really caught me by surprise. So let me just go over some of the songs in just kind of point form. I'm not going to go over them into great detail. I think it's worth going over, though, just to give you an idea of what I'm trying to get over here in terms of the songwriting. So the first song is Out of the Sun, which is very upbeat and has that very California vibe I was talking about. The singing is fantastic. Patrick's keyboard playing is great. And that little hint of progressive I'm talking about is in this song, where they have the sort of odd time change in the bridge. The solo that Patrick does on the Moog is very nice, but the one thing I noticed throughout this record is that his sound on the Moog is very dry. There's no reverb or delay or nothing, and it really kind of sticks out. And when you put your headphones on and listen to it, it almost feels like the Moog is going to just come right out front and pop you in the nose. It's so out front. There's also great singing in this, and the harmony singing is really, really well done. So right out of the gate, I was very surprised by this song. The second song is called Rana Batucada. Now, this is more getting back to the South American way of things. It's a very mysterious beginning, really nice piano playing, and it kind of has that South American flavor in there. It has some chanting and hand drums and traditional handshakers and stuff like that. And this song in particular is a very good showcase for Patrick's piano playing. It is an instrumental song, so it's very interesting how he keeps everybody's interest just strictly on piano. There is some also melodies done with the keyboard and guitar, but this is mainly a showcase on piano. Now we get to what I believe is the best song on this record, which is song number 3, called Nervous Breakdown. It has a very catchy keyboard intro, and the guitar and bass playing on this is really good. And this is the song that almost kind of bordered on hard rock for me. It also has a little bit of that classical influence that Patrick Mraz is known for. And if I can summarize this song in one comparison, it would be that it's almost like Yes meets Queen. Fantastic song, incredible guitar soloings and singing. And I absolutely love this song. I think it's one of the best songs I've heard Patrick do, hands down. Side A ends with Silver Screen, which is a sort of attempt at a very commercial-sounding ballad, almost. Again, it has very much a Queen influence. And this being 76, 77, obviously Night at the Opera and Day at the Races were out already by this time, and I'm sure had an influence on his writing, as it did many people's once Queen released those records. So I wasn't surprised to kind of hear that styling in this song. It's a really nice ballad. Great singing again. Lots of sort of electronic piano sounds. And I definitely think that this was their attempt at the hit single of the album. So that takes us over to side B. So side B starts with a song called Tentacles. Now, this song is kind of odd. It's a piano piece, essentially, with some Hammond organ. The lyrics are really odd, and it kind of reminds me of Meatloaf. There's some great drumming on this, and it's more on the commercial side of things again, but the way the vocals are structured and the sort of comical lyrics that are within it, it really reminds me of some very early Meatloaf sort of material. Song 6 is Kabbalah, which, again, now we go back to that South American influence. It's more progressive. It definitely shows a lot more of those South American stylings, and it has within it also some very interesting sort of computer-generated tones in the background. So it's almost like futuristic South American music. The main melody within it is very interesting because he plays on keyboards, the main melody, and the sound from the keyboards is very much like vibes almost, or like a xylophone. So it's very interesting sort of instrumental song. The next song after that is song 7, which I think is the second best song on the whole album. And this is a song called Love, Hate, Sun, Rain, You. Now, the beginning of the song is interesting because it's clearly a keyboard, but it's a very distorted sound, almost like a lead guitar. And it sounds really good. I really love it. It's another upbeat song, very much more on the hard rock end of things. But it has some great lead guitar playing on this. Really, really well done. The singer is absolutely unbelievable on this song. And more than anything, this song kind of reminds me of a more progressive version of Boston. Lots of great guitar harmonies, some really great singing, and he really hits the stratospheres vocally on some of these parts on this song. So it's very interesting. And the last song on the record, Time for Change, is the epic of the album. It's broken into four pieces, which is Time to Fly, Big Bands of Ancient Temples, Serenade, and Back to Nature. Now, again, this kind of has both elements in there. It has the sort of South American, but there's also some sort of Oriental Japanese influence in this as well. The beginning of this song very much has some Oriental percussion and some mysterious keyboard tones in it. The soloing is really well done. And again, it's very piano-based, very electronic piano-based as well. And it's one of those things where I believe Patrick wanted to show at the end that he hadn't forgotten what got him to the game, so to speak. He's very much a progressive player, and people know him as a progressive player, especially with his work with Yes when he did Relayer. So I think this song is sort of a nod of the hat to that sort of style of writing and playing. So a really good song, and well written, and it's definitely well sung. So overall, like I said, this album really surprised me. I found myself going back and listening to it again a couple of times in a row, actually, because I really enjoyed it. It was a very quick 40 minutes, and I highly recommend this album. Out of 10, I would give this album definitely a 9. There's not much on this album that I can criticize at all. It's interesting. The playing is very well done. The production of it is very good as well. And I think more than anything, this album represents sort of Patrick showing the world that he isn't just a one-trick pony playing just progressive music or South American-based progressive music, that he can do a lot more than that. He can write commercial music, he can write ballads, he can do it all. And on this record, he really proves that to me. So would I recommend getting this? Absolutely. And if you don't have it in your collection, you should really think about getting it. So there you have it, A Trip Down Memory Lane. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that this album is definitely, as I mentioned just now, a must-have in everyone's collection. And the more I look back at Patrick's career, I am sort of surprised that they never asked him back. I mean, Rick came back to this band quite a few times. I would have loved to have seen what it would have been like if they would have brought back Patrick for one more stint in this band. So anyways, those are my thoughts, and now let's go over to Kevin.
So the next person to leave the band, Patrick Mraz, came up with his second solo album. I can't imagine why I kept seeing that it was his first solo album. That's just wrong. Anyway, Mark's with me here now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. So, you really enjoyed the album, and I enjoyed a few bits of it, but there were other bits that, from my review, you will have heard, I didn't really like at all. And the thing which upset me about it really was that there didn't seem to be a great deal of cohesion. There were lots of different styles of music which seemed to be kind of thrown in together. And, you know, listening to it all the way through, I couldn't really get a hold of where it was going or what Patrick Mraz thought he was doing. Do you think he was trying a few things out in his second solo album? And of course, he'd just left Yes, so perhaps he was trying to find what the future held for him.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. I think that, you know, like I said before, it just seems like when you're in a band situation, you have to conform to, you know, the group dynamic and what everybody kind of agrees on. You have to kind of follow suit. So when you're by yourself, you can do whatever you want, right? So I'm guessing that maybe the things that he was hoping to do in a band situation and couldn't, he's now has the freedom to go ahead and do them in his solo works.
Yeah. So, I mean, things like the epic at the end, the progressive epic, Time for a Change, I thought was fantastic. But some of the other things like the Nervous Breakdown and Silver Screen and those sorts of things I thought were much less effective. But then again, you have the other aspect to it, which is what you talked about, the rock and roll, the very strong singing from John McBurney. It was absolutely fantastic. And that dalliance with a sort of commercial aspect to Patrick Mraz's work. And I've not heard Patrick Mraz, which is his next solo album. So I'm just wondering which way he decided to go. I was, from some of the reactions that I'd read around the internet, I was expecting this very much to be a Story of I Part 2. And there are some Brazilian elements, but like you said in your review as well, it's certainly not predominantly those Brazilian influences in this one, is it?
No, I mean, I think that there's a lot more rock in there, which obviously the vocalist John brought in with his style of singing, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it was funny when I was going through my notes and was taking my dog out for a walk this morning. When I listened back to some of the songs again, I just couldn't help but get this feeling come over me, like from the opener, right? When you listen to the first song, It very much sounds like a very optimistic, happy kind of summer song. I can almost envision like a scene of like Woodstock with, you know, tons of people outside with in their shorts and no shirt on and just enjoying the sun with sunglasses on. That's the kind of vibe I got from a lot of the songs on here. You know what I mean? It almost came across as like sort of happy Woodstock material almost, you know? Yeah. But then of course, you know, he can't help but put in his, you know, Brazilian influences into it in certain spots, but they're not nearly as heavy as they were in the prior record.
No, they're not. And I was fascinated to see that YouTube video, and I would suggest that everyone listening goes and sees that YouTube video, which I've put into the show notes for this week, for the Rana Batacuda. Now, I didn't know anything about that, so I did try and look it up, and anyone who speaks Spanish will probably have lots to say about my pronunciation and what the words mean. But I think Rana, as I said in my piece, means frog. And then this wonderful Brazilian concept of the batacuda, which is, I suppose, a kind of dance. And you get this bateria of percussion instruments playing this. And it's one of the songs, I assume, one of the tunes that you have in something like a carnival. And that, I think that really worked very well. And I really liked the way that he combined that with his amazing own, you know, synth playing, and he was soloing over the top of it and that. And it reminded me very much of my reaction to Rick Wakeman. And I, in both of those, even in the parts of this album that I didn't like as much, I can still appreciate Mraz's fabulous keyboard work and Wakeman's fabulous keyboard work, even when I didn't like the overall effect. So there's a bit of a parallel there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, you're not going to be able to please everybody, right? With your releases, sometimes people put out stuff that, you know, connect with people, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I found it interesting that you not disliked, but how much of it you didn't like compared to myself, because usually We're not too far off with our likings of records. But you know, it that's what makes everything interesting, right? If we liked everything the same way, it would be pretty dull.
Yeah, that's right. And the thing I really didn't like was what I described rather rudely as lounge music, when he pulls out the electric piano and that sort of thing. Now, when he converted that into, as you said, stuff that sounds like Boston, or I said rather rudely again, the Doobie Brothers, it works. And I think that works really well. And I think some of the pop writing in there is great. The stuff that I couldn't bear was the middle of the road stuff, which did sound like it was being played late at night in a casino bar or something like that. So that's my prejudice coming out there, of course. But so I think he can do some very interesting pop things, especially. But so the others just didn't work for me. But what's fascinating is that how far he's now moved away from, as you said as well, the Yes aesthetic, the progressive aesthetic. And it reminded me a little bit of someone like Peter Gabriel. So when Peter Gabriel left Genesis, that first album he came out with, he was, you know, nobody, you know, he deliberately said he was trying to move far away from Genesis because he didn't want everyone saying, oh, look, you know, Peter Gabriel's gone out of Genesis and then is just producing the same stuff. So often that is the case, isn't it? When you leave a band, you want to do something very different so that you're not continually compared to what the band is doing.
Yeah, you don't want to be looked at as a one-trick pony, right?
Yeah.
You want to go and show them that you have more to offer than that. And I think that this is exactly why he did this, I think. Now, it's fascinating that you said that, because right when you were talking about that, it kind of dawned on me that this might be a very strong reason why he did that, because, you know, he gets out of a huge band like Yes, and now he's on his own doing his stuff. But of course, you know, people like Patrick want to be involved in sort of a band dynamic as well. So your next record or the next couple of records that you do are almost looked at as like a resume. So when a band is looking for somebody else, of course, they're going to try to look at the person that they're interested in and look at their most recent work. So if you're only showing that you can do one sort of thing, then maybe the band might not be interested in it. But if you can show that you can do pop, you can do this, you can do, you know, South American, you can do jazz, you can do rock and roll, then all of a sudden you're much more appealing. And then lo and behold, boom, Moody Blues come knocking for him. And then he gets into another band situation. So to me, it almost seemed like those albums might have helped him in getting that position, because, you know, if he only showed one element of his style, then maybe they wouldn't have been as interested.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, the Moody Blues, because, you know, they went through their progressive phase, didn't they? And then they entered a much more commercial, or supposedly commercial, middle-of-the-road type music. And that's the point at which Patrick joined them. So, yes, maybe they did listen to this album and think this guy could be good for us. So that's fascinating. But I think really the one that works best for me, Time for a Change, there's quite a bit of electronica in there, isn't there? There's quite a bit of strange sci-fi noises. But the way that he combines all those, I think, is really excellently done, and reminded me more of those other keyboard wizards, you know, Vangelis or Jean-Michel Jarre, those sorts of people who try and push the boundaries of what the electronic instruments were capable of on their own. So that's why, particularly at the start, the Time to Fly section of that I thought was really excellent. And then I think it did hang together really well. So, you know, unlike what you have in someone like Mike Oldfield that I mentioned earlier, where you have something like Crises, which has got some deliberately commercial songs on one side, and then the whole of the second side, like on Crises, where he has a suite. This is not as effective for me as that. I think Time for a Change and maybe one or two of the others could have been extended and elaborated and really made into something much more interesting, and then leaving space just for some of the more successful of the more pop ones. What did you think of Time for a Change?
I think that a lot of what you said is correct. Sure, he could have definitely expanded on it and made it much more elaborate. Again, I think it all has to go back to the fact that I think that he very much wanted to get as much of his different elements in it as possible. So of course certain things are going to suffer because of it time-wise, and of course back then, being that vinyl was really the only real method or format of putting stuff out, you had a strict amount of time in which to do it, right? If he was making this record when CD format was available, maybe he could have made these into much longer pieces without any fear, right? But, you know, I think that you brought up a good point, that the electronic stuff that he did at the beginning is something that I think Patrick Mraz gets, I mean, I'm not going to say not enough credit for, but maybe deserves a bit more credit, because he's very good at these kind of, you know, finding new kind of gear or newish gear and kind of trying to take it to the limit of its of what it can do technically. And I always found he found some interesting sounds out of these instruments.
Yeah.
And it's something that He did a very little, I think, in Yes, like, you know, Gates of Delirium and stuff like that, and Sound Chaser, he did a little bit of that in there. But, you know, as his solo records progressed, and even if you look at records much later, like in the 80s even, he had some really out there kind of sequencing stuff going on, and it's because of, of his love of this sort of experimentation.
Yeah, and he is one of those, like we mentioned before, he is as versatile as any other keyboardist that you could mention, because as I said last week, the Main Horse stuff that he did, where he did some of the best Hammond soloing I've ever heard, and really played that instrument as well as anyone else that I can think of. And then he has the jazz influences, he has the flying up and down the keyboard, he has the piano, the virtuoso piano playing, and he has the South American stuff, and then he also has the electronic music stuff as well. He is really a remarkable musician and a musician of many parts. But what I wanted to do was have a little pause now to think about who we've talked about so far in this series of What Did They Do Next, and who was the most successful straight away after they left the band. So if we think back to Tony Kaye and Peter Banks, both of whose first efforts we thought were really good, then we come up to Bill Bruford. Of course, he went on to King Crimson, and his first effort was pretty spectacular. And then we come on to Rick Wakeman himself. It was very successful. That was sure. He sold many, many thousands, millions of copies of that Myths. And then this one, which is, for me, not quite as good. Now, I wonder what we're going to come up to in the future. So what's been your favorite of the ones that we've looked at so far?
Well, it's interesting because every one that we've talked about so far has had its, moments of brilliance and then not so brilliant. But it's difficult because to me, I always have this battle between just two of them, which is Bill and Rick, right? Because, for example, Rick for me will always be my, one of my favorite guys. He always has been from Yes. Yeah. And just in general, he's probably one of my favorite keyboard players ever. So I always have a slight lean toward his material. But if I have to be completely honest, I think as far as successful, not only, in terms of sales, because it didn't do poorly, but I think more as far as something that people look back at now and think has aged excellently, you have to go with Bill in the King Crimson release. I mean, that album to this day is still looked at as one of the classic records in progressive rock. And, while it may not have sold, a quadzillion million copies like, Rick's records did back then, but it still sold decently. It still did very well. And I think more importantly, if you were to say, what record do you like better amongst the prog community between Lark's Tongue and, Arthur, I think it would be a pretty substantial lean towards Lark's Tongues.
The nice thing is, though, that we've managed to go through quite a range of different kinds of music, haven't we? I mean, we've had the Badger stuff with Tony Kaye, and we've had Flash with Peter Banks, which is wonderful, and then this Patrick Mraz and the Arthur. We've had a really good trip so far.
Yeah, for sure.
So I wonder who's next. So we've got to wait quite some significant time now, actually, before the next departure from the band. And we've got to get through Rick Wakeman rejoining for Going for the One, and then Tormato, and then finally 1979, those Paris sessions. And in fact, two members of the band left then. That was John Anderson and Rick Wakeman. So I suggest that we come next to John Anderson and what he did after that 1979 debacle. So looking forward to that. But don't take our word for all the things we've said today about this album. What did you think of it? If you managed to listen to it on Spotify or on YouTube with the video that I embedded last week, let us know what you think of this album and whether Patrick had it right when he left the band. But for the moment, Mark, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Hello, this is Patrick Mraz, and you are listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Just before we go, here's the patron update. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons, or half of them, are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian N.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Jeremy North, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Also continued thanks to Robert and David, as usual. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them as we approach episode 400 of the podcast in helping to keep the show going financially and having access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please do keep up with us by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.